Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In November 2024, Donald Trump won a second term as President of the United States. This election win followed his defeat by Joe Biden in 2020. And in the aftermath of that election, Trump contested the result. According to a special counsel's report of a Department of Justice investigation, Trump suggested that there had been election and voter fraud and pressed his vice president, Mike Pence, to not certify the election results. Now that Donald Trump is back in the White House, what does this mean for voting rights and democracy in America? To discuss this, in February 2025, I spoke to Michael Lattner, professor of political science at California Polytechnic State University, and Director of Research on Democratic Reform at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. His research interests include voting rights, representation, and electoral system design, and his latest co-authored book is Gerrymandering the States: Partisanship, Race, and the Transformation of American Federalism, published in 2021.
What brought me to the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute was an opportunity to develop a research program to address the challenges facing the protection of the voting rights and the institutions of democracy in this new legal and political landscape, where we face two distinct dilemmas, one of which are the social and demographic changes in racial composition and even racial identity that define the protected classes of citizens under the Voting Rights Act, in addition to the erosion of the legal protections defined by the Voting Rights Act, which were designed to enforce the right of political equality under the 14th Amendment for all under the U.S. Constitution.
So in the U.S., our listeners may or may not know that the states are responsible for administering elections for the most part. What sort of influence can President Trump and the second term of the Trump administration have on these elections?
I mean, as you say, states are largely responsible, but they're also subject to compliance with the laws for federal elections, where Congress has authority over their own elections. And that's the way that a lot of federal election law is actually enforced, because state and federal elections are typically run simultaneously. But there are numerous ways that the federal government shapes the entire electoral process, starting with Congress, which is narrowly under the control of the Trump administration and his party. So we can start there, look at what federal election laws are on the table. And so we could start with the proposal out of the House of Representatives called the SAVE Act. And their Republican leadership under Speaker Johnson is trying to make law which would require every citizen to provide a birth certificate, passport, or other citizenship documents to register or re-register to vote. Now, this may sound like common sense legislation as a way to verify that only eligible citizens can vote. Every state in the union already ensures that voter eligibility is verified for every ballot that is cast in elections. And every election year, in fact, thousands of ballots are rejected in states when election administrators can't verify the eligibility of voters' ballots. Studies of ballot rejection actually show that most of those rejected ballots actually come from eligible citizens who have either made errors in their voting records or their residency records, or their citizenship can't be confirmed for, you know, whatever specific election. So this legislation not only fails to address the actual registration problems that eligible voters face, it places additional burdens on voters, which, as a recent study by Kevin Morris and Cora Henry at the Brennan Center for Justice show, would impact over 20 million voters who don't have easy access to citizenship documentation. And so for this act to become legislation, we'd really be talking about a catastrophic disruption of the voter registration process for millions who currently register online or by mail, for example. They'd have to present citizenship documents in person. This sounds ridiculous, but of course it is ridiculous for a reason. If Congress were serious about ensuring that only eligible citizens could vote, then they'd implement a national voter registration system, provide identification to eligible voters, as most civilized democracies do, without the additional burden of having to register to vote. That's something that is pretty rare among democracies, actually. But of course, that's not Congress's goal. Their goal is to amplify fear about conspiracies surrounding the 2020 presidential election, to bend voter participation in favor of their supporters, and to ensure their continued control of government. There's the legislative turn. There's also the impact of the courts to consider. They're supposed to be the referees that regulate partisan political competition. And as I'm sure your listeners know, the Trump administration and their state allies have continued to advance under the veil of what is called independent state legislature theory. The capacity for Trump-aligned legislators in the states to not only weaken the ability of state courts to enforce equal protection laws provided by state constitutions, but to directly attack the 14th Amendment procedures guaranteed to all voters through increasingly successful challenges to the Voting Rights Act and other voting protection mechanisms that are specifically designed to protect voters from the discriminatory practices of state legislatures. So it's really moving in entirely the opposite direction from the intended law. Even that process where we use to allocate power to populations through Congress, that's administered by the executive branch, and it's susceptible to corruption. So we can go all the way to the conduct of the census. As you well know, every 10 years, the census is conducted in the United States for the purpose of allocating seats to Congress by population. It's the single most important and expensive thing that our government does outside of national defense. And the last Trump administration already demonstrated their intent to manipulate census results, manipulate the science, include citizenship questions on the census, which would further reduce response rates, make it harder to contact hard to find voters, and literally make people invisible by not having their presence recorded in the census. So there's a wide array that the federal government in general and the Trump administration in particular will affect election law in the future.
And just to kind of to build on that, you mentioned the Voting Rights Act. And that's to say, my impression is that a lot of these attacks on voting or the right to vote are not entirely new. The Voting Rights Act has been chipped away at, would be one way of saying it, over the last 10 or 15 years or so. Could you talk a bit about that and how that has sort of flowed into what's happening now?
Yeah, absolutely. The Supreme Court has grown increasingly less comfortable, and one could say that the post-civil rights movement consensus that had developed around the protection of voting rights. And what I mean by consensus is that all the branches of government agreed that this was something that was important for government to do. And so you had 50 years of strong enforcement of voting rights and enforcement of the 14th Amendment under the Voting Rights Act. That began to be chipped away, and that consensus broke pretty decisively with the 2013 Shelby County v. Holder decision that gutted the capacity for the government to have require states to have preclearance before they changed any election laws. That was the big effect of the Shelby decision. Since then, in the decade that has followed, there have been a number of other decisions. I think most significantly, the Brnovich decision a few years ago that further reduced the capacity to enforce Section 2. We're seeing continual challenges to Section 2, which is the remaining provision within the Voting Rights Act that allows private parties to come and bring litigation to protect voting rights. And so we've seen this continued breakdown of this consensus. And indeed, with regard to the SAVE Act that I mentioned earlier, we can see that there really is just a real breakdown in the intent to enforce voting rights and political equality, not just from the courts who, you know, as I mentioned, are increasingly skeptical of using, for example, race-conscious districting. This is a big question that came out of the Alabama case recently, which upheld the process and the scientific test to identify and remedy racial vote dilution, but also the language within those decisions. If you read the opinions of the justices, clearly they're looking at a temporal timeline and a limit on the very concept of race conscious districting. And so whether it's sooner or later, we are seeing a nearly complete erosion on what was a consensus to protect voting rights in the country.
So earlier this month, the Federal Election Commissioner and Chair, Ellen Weintraub, claimed that Donald Trump tried to fire her. Why would Trump do this, and is this something that we should be worried about?
Well, I can't pretend to get inside the president's mind and determine why he would do a lot of the things that he does. However, I think it's clear that while there is some question over the legality of moving an FEC commissioner who is a holdover from a previous administration, there's certainly no question that Congress explicitly and intentionally created the FEC as an independent, bipartisan federal agency whose commissioners are supposed to be confirmed by Congress. Congress did not grant the president the power to fire FEC commissioners in the law. And, you know, if one looks at patterns of behavior, it's fairly obvious that the president is engaging in a bit of revenge. Weintraub led the FEC complaint filed against Trump's campaign in the political committees that were related to his campaign for concealing payments of around $7 million that were legal fees paid through unrelated shell corporations in violation of campaign finance law. Weintraub has been an architect of some of the strategies to actually enforce campaign finance laws throughout the country when the FEC itself was basically toothless. The way that the FEC is set up is that it's a bipartisan commission with three Republicans and three Democrats. So as you might imagine, there's often deadlock in terms of the policy decisions that the FEC makes. They're more of a non-decision commission. And she actually led a strategy to further weaken the capacity of the FEC so that campaign finance laws could actually be enforced through the courts. She is a, you know, a voting rights advocate herself and a defender of democratic institutions. And so she may be a thorn in the president's side.
So in 2020, for the LSE US Center's USAP blog, you wrote on how gerrymandering in the states could lead to President Trump's re-election. Could you talk a bit about what you meant by this? And is this still a possibility for future presidential elections?
Oh, that's a great question. So in that piece, what we were doing was pointing out that if the 2020 election results were as close in battleground states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin as they were in 2016, that there would be strong partisan incentive for those state legislatures to intervene, select their own electors to the Electoral College, as they had attempted to do in Florida in 2000. And as your listeners, I'm sure, recall, Trump did, in fact, conspire to initiate just the type of fake elector plan that we had alluded to in that article in the aftermath of his 2020 election loss. He and his campaign team submitted documents in several states, all of which had been won by Joe Biden, that falsely claimed that to be the legitimate electoral certificates for President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence. Members of state legislatures in some of these states were colluders on this conspiracy. And so this is exactly the sort of danger that we were pointing to. I will say that there have been some revisions to the Electoral Count Act, which is federal legislation governing the certification of federal elections. In the aftermath of President Trump's attempt to overturn the election through violence on January 6th, after that fake elector plan had failed, the Electoral Count Reform Act was passed, I believe, in 2022, and that addressed some of the specific issues on the federal end, that is, by regulating the judicial process and the process for judicial review, there are unclear election results, clarifying the vice president's role in the certification of the electoral votes, for example. But the core problem, which is really the capacity of state legislatures to manipulate the electoral process, whether it's through voter registration purges on the front end, prohibitions against voter registration drives, unclear ballot rejection procedures, or on the back end, the capacity to manipulate the certification of state election results, those have not been adequately addressed. And so there's a lot that we need to do to rein in state legislators and state legislatures requiring public disclosure, for example, of ballot data when early voting starts, so that the number and status of ballots is publicized and understood. The data is transparent. The ballots, knowing where they are in the chain of custody, using ballot tracking requirements, for example, again, in the with the goal of transparency so that people can see what's happening to their votes, requiring the use of voting machines that provide paper ballots, requiring election jurisdictions to conduct true risk-limiting audits if they're capable of doing so, specifying security procedures to challenge ballots, prevent attempts to halt ballot processing at the precinct and county level. These are some of the tactics that, as state legislatures favorable to President Trump and the Republican Party have increasingly been able to politicize the certification process, that is replacing independent bureaucrats with political appointees. All of these practices raise the prospect of possible election manipulation. And there's a lot we need to be doing in order to ensure the integrity of our elections. But unfortunately, that's not a priority for the current administration.
Thinking about the kind of guardrails that sort of prevent, as you said, sort of independent electoral college votes from coming into the system, and Vice President Pence was sort of one of those guardrails in 2020. Where do you see these guardrails as being at coming up to, say, 2028? And what happens if there isn't a figure like Mike Pence who's willing to uphold them?
Well, we should be clear, there is no figure like Mike Pence willing to uphold them. The guardrails are gone. Vice President J.D. Vance has already, you know, publicly stated that he would have complied with President Trump's orders if he were in the position of Vice President Pence. So there are no guardrails. And that's what makes this particular era so dangerous, is the fact that political institutions don't stand up on their own. Ultimately, the function and performance of political institutions and law and order more generally lies with the capacity of people willing to follow the law. And to the extent that those people are missing from the process, whether that's in independent agencies or in, you know, any at any level of political leadership, that makes this era one in which democracy is under a level of threat that we haven't seen in generations.
This year, 2025, is an off year for elections in the U.S., but there are still a few contests, notably in New Jersey and Virginia. Which states should we be keeping an eye on this year in terms of voting rights and in the lead up to the 2026 midterm elections?
It's a very good question. The off-cycle elections are important to watch for a number of reasons, particularly with concern to voting rights. The practices of state legislatures and election administrators, these are this serve as sort of a testing ground in terms of what we are likely to see in the next on-cycle election. And so, particularly in Virginia, you have a very competitive state legislature, and so the stakes are quite high there. That's where we're most likely to see actors trying to maximize partisan advantage, and the tools and tactics that they use, if successful, may catch on in the next on-cycle election. And so it is important to keep an eye on those elections, not just state elections, but local elections as well. And with that, I would add that there are a number of things to look out for in terms of attempts to improve the function of elections. And so that includes the movement to enact and enforce state voting rights acts in several states. And so either through the initiative or the legislative process, a number of states are working on either implementing or revising essentially state versions of the same protections provided by the Voting Rights Act and provided by the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. In battleground states, places like Michigan, where you have a very serious group of integrity-minded election folks at the Secretary of State's office, and in the public, Michigan was one of the states that passed through the initiative process a pretty extensive set of electoral reforms to eliminate partisan gerrymandering and improve election administration. So those movements are still going on. And there are a number of states a few battleground states, but also places you might not normally think of as, you know, hotbeds of reform, where there is action happening in the state legislatures, and there are well-intended attempts to improve the electoral process and election administration throughout the states.
Just to kind of follow up on the kind of well-intentioned processes to improve elections, is there a partisan split there? Is it more the Democratic states that are trying to improve things and the Republican states not, or is there a mixture?
Yeah, I mean, it is a pretty bifurcated event in the sense that, you know, there are GOP-controlled state legislatures that are, you know, intent on further weakening election administration and election laws. But that said, there are an important set of reforms where we are seeing bipartisan agreement. And it's important to note that a lot of the efforts to improve the administration and to modernize voter registration, many of those reforms were actually led by Republicans. In Oregon and Washington, automatic voter registration, universal vote by mail, these were efforts that were initiated by Republicans, and there are still several areas where committed public servants, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, are working together to improve the integrity of elections. You're just not seeing it happen at the federal level.
According to exit polls from the 2024 election, 80% of those who voted for Kamala Harris felt that the most important issue was democracy. And that compares to only 18% of those who voted for Donald Trump. What's going on here?
Well, in part, you're seeing the campaign effects, right? Kamala Harris and her campaign made democracy a priority in their campaign, and that was a continuation of President Biden's influence and the Biden administration's emphasis on democracy and the preservation of democratic institutions. On the other side, you know, there's really no way to get around the fact that a large percentage of President Trump's supporters are convinced that he won the 2020 election and that there is mass conspiracy to keep him out of power, that there are millions of illegal ballots being cast and the like. And so what we mean by democracy, I think, means different things for different people. And the way that the debate is framed, I think if you generally, outside of the campaign context, you know, one of the sort of paradoxical features that we see in public opinion data is that there's no shortage of democratic values. When you ask people, generally speaking, about the importance of democracy, about the desire to have free and fair elections, the basic components of democracy, the support and approval of basic democratic institutions remains quite high. But when you put it in the political context of a presidential campaign, that strongly shapes people's views, almost in the way that some of your listeners might have looked at public opinion data on the economy. And there are economic miracles that occur the day after an election where one party's supporters believe that the state of the economy has collapsed and that we're all going to hell in a handbasket. And the other side believes that the economy is now on the right track. And it just depends on which party won the presidency.
So what would you say are the most important threats to voting rights and democracy in America right now?
Well, Chris, where do I start? That is a big question. Certainly, we can, at the more formal procedures and the immediate threats to existing voting rights and procedures, the Supreme Court of the United States is going to have opportunities to either protect or further erode the Voting Rights Act this summer. There are still some state congressional and other cases regarding the districting from the 2020 election cycle that are still in question, they're still being litigated, and so that could further erode voting rights. The broader erosion of democratic norms that this administration is engaging in, you know, is dangerous for a number of reasons, not so much election related, but certainly voting rights and voting equality related threats that are quite numerous. But I think the longer term threat to democracy and voting rights is just the difficulty of overcoming the barriers for reform. As you well know, the last massive structural transformation of American democracy was the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And that regime held, you know, it held for half a century. But we are in a different era now. And so the challenge for U.S. voters, citizens, for advocates of democracy everywhere is to figure out what we're going to do next and where do we go, because we no longer enjoy the protections that were established by the Voting Rights Act. As we've already discussed, voting rights are continually under threat at the state and federal level. And so what we really need to think through and have a public discourse about where we want our democracy to go. And that's going to be a painful conversation. It's going to be a partisan conversation. And we are in a period of regime change, but it is also the case that the country has lived under undemocratic regimes before. And for most of the country's history, large sections of the population were excluded from the franchise, lived essentially in a state without voting rights. And so it's not as though, you know, we've never been in this position before. So it's really a question of public mobilization, public education, and generating the political will to enforce voting rights for everyone. And that's going to require legislation. Obviously, the federal government's not going to be very responsive to any advances in voting rights legislation over the next few years. And so again, I think the place to look is to look at reform movements at the state and even local level for signs of where the democracy movement is going in this country, because there is a reaction, there is an active and growing democracy movement, and that's going to shape the future of voting rights at the federal level eventually.
And thinking about what you've just said, what do you think American democracy will look like at the end of Trump's term, at the beginning of 2029?
I am not a forecaster, so I cannot see the future. And frankly, there's so many unknowns in terms of how things go on many levels to make any kind of a prediction like that. I mean, obviously, to the extent that there's an economic or natural disaster or something that really harms the administration's political future, it's hard to say how those things are going whether or not things are going to get much worse before they get better, or whether things are just going to slowly continue to erode the way that we're seeing happen today. I will say, though, again, I just mentioned the growth of, you know, an ongoing democracy movement in this country, to the extent that there is greater recognition that people's voting rights are under threat and that the quality of American democracy is eroding, that gives energy to pro-democracy movements. And so ultimately, and I think you're seeing this again across states and in municipalities, across parties, frankly, we are seeing the sorts of conversations that we need to happen are starting to happen. And so, I'm optimistic on two fronts. On the one hand, I think things can always get worse, and they almost certainly will. But in the long run, we are seeing the sort of organization, the voting rights community, the civil rights community, are having conversations about the sort of long-term structural reforms we need to actually embody the level of democratic support that we do see in the public.
One thing that we've seen recently is increasing concern about Trump overturning the 22nd Amendment in some way, effectively running for or having a third term. Is this something that we should be concerned about, or are there other issues that are more pressing, perhaps?
Again, this is within a long line of the breaking of democratic norms, right? And so we're not talking about anything that's actually happened in terms of a violation of the law, but clearly, he's publicly entertaining a third term. There is conversation among legislators about how that might be, how you might thread that needle. So yeah, it's absolutely something we should be concerned about. But I think it's a mistake for democracy advocates to be too caught up in what the president is saying at any one time, because that's just a recipe for insanity. It's more important to watch what the president does and what the administration does, because those are the sorts of procedural actions and the politicization of committees and commissions and all of the instruments that are used to regulate the executive. The erosion of those protections are really at the core of, we keep having this conversation and are continuing to have this conversation of the threat of authoritarianism or the decline of democracy. Are we in decline? Where are we on the democracy scale on any given day? In my view, we ought to be paying less attention to what the president says. Of course, now what the president says, there are sometimes shocking things and important allusions to, you know, where we might be headed. So when the president says that someone saving their country can break no laws, you know, this is something that President Nixon said something similar, but it was already after he had been impeached and left office in disgrace. And so this idea that the strong man and the president can do no wrong, or that the president is somehow above the law, those are important words, but it's really what the administration is doing to actually erode the protections, both the regulations on the executive branch and in our democratic protections that are most important. And so, I'm paying more attention to how is the census going to be conducted? Who's in charge? These are the sort of deep structural threats that really mark a true decline in our democratic capacity when we are eroding and manipulating those fundamental institutions that we use to make democracy survive.
And just before we finish, I'd just like to invite you to direct our listeners' attention to any new projects you're working on or anything else you think might be of interest to them.
I will say we're early in the process, but the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute has launched the Guinier Project, and we are working on a large-scale set of research projects associated with the Guinier Project, one of which is a comprehensive review of sort of where are we now with regard to political science. What do we know about voting rights protections, and what do we know about the sorts and the effectiveness of reforms that provide protection for voting rights and provide political equality, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And so we are conducting a large assessment of the latest science and where the scientific consensus is on designing institutions to protect voting rights. And so we'll be putting out quite a bit of research on that in the future and working with organizations to implement and to think through the best sorts of reforms for any given political context. One thing that we do know is that there's no magic bullet. There's no single set of reforms that are going to save us, but there are important improvements that we can make in the functioning of our democracy.
Well, our listeners should definitely look out for that. Professor Michael Lattner, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thanks so much.
Michael Lattner is professor of political science at California Polytechnic State University and director of research on democratic reform at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Michael Lattner for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Arrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. Helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.